This Tridio production is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and made possible by you, our listener. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit tridio.com/donate.
You're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, episode number 23.
I'm a doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years. I am Scottish. I can complain about things.
Shush. Hi, I'm Don Bettinelli, and you're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, where we discuss the latest episodes of the hit series Doctor Who. Today we're discussing the first episode of Season 10, or Series 10 if you're British, called The Pilot. And joining me today on the panel are Father Corey Sticker from... Father Corey Stika. I want to say it right.
Thank you.
I knew right away it was wrong. All the way from Malta, Montana. Hi, Father Corey.
How's it going?
It's great. We have new Doctor Who, so it's got to be great.
That's always a good thing. Yes, it is.
And also joining us again is Jimmy Akin from San Diego.
Howdy. How's it going?
It's great, Jimmy. I'm just so excited to get to, you know, get together again and talk about Doctor Who. It's been a while. I mean, We talked after the Christmas special, the 2016 Christmas special, but apart from that, we haven't had a regular episode of Doctor Who since December of 2015. That's a year right. And 4 months. It's crazy.
It's one of those scheduling things this time. They didn't crank it out immediately.
It's kind of interesting I think it might be a British TV thing, but it's also, I think, a way that even American TV is getting, where we have these indeterminate gaps between seasons and these long periods without our favorite shows. Do these long gaps hurt the show, or does it hurt your enjoyment of the show? Let me put it that way. Jimmy, is this too long? Obviously, we'd love to have an episode every week, but what do you think of these long gaps that we get sometimes?
Well, I'm kind of used to it at this point. In a way, it's kind of a natural consequence of the development of the internet, because a lot of people's viewing is... we have so many more options now than when you and I were kids, when you had the three networks and that's all you had to watch. And so you didn't have a lot of choices. But today we have VCRs and, you know, Blu-ray and DVR and YouTube and streaming. And we have so many more options that it's not as essential to have the same thing every week. In particular with Doctor Who, even though it's nice to have new episodes, Doctor Who fans have extra options even within mm-hmm. the Doctor Who universe, because the TV show is only part of it. It's, in a way, it's kind of the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more Doctor Who media out there. And so during the time that Doctor Who's been off television, I've been doing other Doctor Who stuff. I watched the animated release of the Patrick Troughton episode. Yep. A few months ago. That was great. I've also been listening to the audio plays that Big Finish produces, which are actually kind of considered canonical. They sometimes refer to them on the TV show, and they have, you know, original actors from the TV show. So you hear former doctors having new adventures with their established companions. And some of them actually are brilliant. There's an audio play, I think it's called Live 23, that is just brilliant. I'd love for them to do something like it on television. What it is it's a Doctor Who adventure told entirely through television broadcasts. Or radio broadcast. So you're listening to these broadcasts of reporters talking about stuff, and then the doctor and his companions show up in the background of those reports, and they get interviewed and things, and the story unfolds in this kind of meta way where you're listening to a play about a show.
So it's kind of the Doctor Who version of War of the Worlds, famous War of the Worlds broadcast.
Exactly.
The whole thing was told through radio announcements.
Same thing, yes. It's really well done.
It's kind of neat in an age where podcasting is becoming bigger and bigger, and we have a particular interest in that. But podcasts are sort of mainstream. The rise of such audio only content is to be expected. You know, it is great to have to be able to have that sort of stuff. You know, we all have our favorite doctors and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. and then their time is over and we feel bad because they're not there anymore. I'll feel bad right. when we don't have Peter Capaldi. I really enjoy him, but to have that ability to listen to the audio plays, there.
Well, the nice thing too with like Big Finish is they really fleshed out the Eighth Doctor.
Mm-hmm, yes,
I mean because he had literally one movie that was mediocre at best.
This was the American incarnation that really yeah. failed.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, that's considered a canonical part of Doctor Who, but it's really an embarrassment. But they took that character, including the actor, and they've really fleshed it out. And so what we saw in the pre-episode to the 50th anniversary episode was this character now that had been fleshed out over these years through Big Finish.
Hmm.
And in fact, in that episode, which is called The Night of the Doctor, and it's right. a mini episode you can watch on YouTube. In that episode, when he's about to regenerate, he actually names his companions from yep. the Big Finish audios.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
So like you said, it's these are canonical. They're part of the accepted. This is official Doctor Who yep. Content. And we see that a little bit in other places, in other sorts of properties. We see Star Wars, they're really particular right. about the canonical versus non-canonical. And in fact, they had that whole extended universe when they came up with the new movies to take everything and move it out of canon, which was a big controversy, and then bringing bits of it back. So it's interesting to see to be like these. It's literally multimedia. It spans media, and there are comic books. There are other books, I guess, novels. Yep. So if you're if you want to, you can find it. But if you're really all about the visual medium, you had a long wait to this one. So we mentioned it. This is the last season with Peter Capaldi as the Doctor, and. Mm-hmm. And even some would say even a bigger deal, Stephen Moffat as the showrunner. Stephen Moffat really put a stamp on Doctor Who, for whether you think it's a good one or a bad one. but he really changed up.
Saying he stomped on the Doctor?
Yes, or stamped or stomped, one or the other. I mean, he really changed things up from his predecessor, Russell T. Davies. I think at least in production values, he took it to the next level. It really is mm-hmm. top-notch production values. So we don't know who the next Doctor is going to be yet, although there are rumors. But we do know that the next showrunner is going to be a gentleman named Chris Chibnall, mm-hmm. who some yeah. may be familiar with.
Yeah. He's most famous for having for being the writer producer of a show called Broadchurch,
yes,
which is
yes.
a British detective show that actually stars David Tennant, the Tenth yes. Doctor.
Yep.
There's a number of Doctor Who alum in the show, which is great.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And then, Rory
Arthur Darvill.
Oh, right, Arthur Darvill.
And Darvill's on there as the priest, the yep. Anglican priest.
And his partner, Ellie, I don't remember the actress's name, but she's been in at least one, but I think several episodes of Who. So, and then other people who've been in other episodes of Who. I feel like there's this small fraternity of British actors who kind of show up in all these different places.
yeah.
But I've really, really enjoyed Broadchurch. I think it's extremely well written.
Yeah.
They're just finishing up their third and final season in Britain.
Oh, wow.
That means, I guess, that Chibnall is clearing the plate, clearing mm-hmm. the decks for Who. But he also has prior experience in the Doctor Who universe. He was mm-hmm. head writer and co-producer for Torchwood, which is the Doctor Who spinoff.
That's right. That's right.
And then he's also written, according to Wikipedia, seven episodes of Doctor Who, but some of those are two-parters and mini-episodes. Yeah. So his first one was the episode 42. That was back in season three.
Which was really good.
Yes, that was David Tennant's Doctor and Martha Jones on a spaceship. It's going to crash into a sun in 42 minutes. So it was one of those high energy, lots going on, lots of tension sort of episodes. So that was
told in real time.
Exactly, told in real time. A very 24-ish. So I was expecting Jack Bauer to run out.
Or
Battlestar Galactica with 33.
Yes, yeah, that's was right. Another one that was real time. Then he did another sort of iconic episodes. It was two-parter, Hungry Earth in Cold Blood. That was season 5. That was with Matt Smith and then Amy and Rory, and the reintroduction or the introduction into the reboot of the Silurians, which
I wasn't as wild about that one.
Yeah, I liked the Silurians. That episode was okay. What did you think of that one, Father Corey?
Yeah, you know, honestly, off the top of my head, I don't remember a lot about it. Maybe that says something, where it wasn't one of those that stood out. Like 42, as soon as you mentioned it, I remember the episode very clearly. But this is one where it's just kind of like, it was interesting, but okay, whatever.
I think that one was significant because it was the one that Rory died, isn't it?
There were several where Rory died.
Yeah, he died quite a few times.
But it's the one where the last one where he died before reappearing
as the
Pandora opens. I think that if I recall correctly, I may be wrong, but that's my recollection is that he gets killed by the Silurian. So then after that was a set of mini episodes called Pond Life. And that was on their website. That was great. It was sort of like these brief glimpses into the life of the ponds. Each one was a different month. So, you know, May, June, July, August. And they were important because they kind of led up to and showed the disintegration of Amy and Rory's marriage before we got into the next season. So that was a very significant one. Dinosaurs on a spaceship, because everybody loves dinosaurs on a spaceship. I just feel like someone sat down in the writer's room one day and said, you know what would be cool? Dinosaurs on a spaceship.
Yep.
Yeah, I think it was a ripoff of Snakes on a Plane.
Yeah, that was just the same thing.
The most overhyped movie, and then you rip it off and produce a really overhyped episode.
Well, they're both basically episodes or movies for one line.
Right.
Yeah. Literally, the whole episode was written around the doctor standing there. There are dinosaurs on a spaceship. That was the whole episode, for that one line.
And a lot of plot holes, and even for the doctor, it was a bit of a contrived solution. There only two shining lights in that. One was Rory's dad, who I really liked.
Yep.
And then, the actor who played the guy who stole the dinosaurs, who's from Game of Thrones, and I had his name and then I lost it. He's the actor from, if you're a Game of Thrones fan, from The Red Wedding.
Unfortunately, I haven't watched any of the Game of Thrones, so I'm out of touch on that one.
The significance to Doctor Who is he has played in a flashback. He's played the first Doctor. And I forget whether it was a mini episode or a flashback in one of the...
Was that the one, or he may be the guy who played William Hartnell in The Adventure of Space and Time, kind of docudrama about the beginning of Doctor Who.
I think that's what it is.
Mark Gatiss wrote.
I think that's the one. I think that's what I'm trying to remember where I saw him, but I remember seeing him as one of the older Doctors. There's an interesting rumor that he's going to show up again as the William Hartnell Doctor in this season near the end. So I don't know.
Which I think that would be wicked cool.
Yeah.
I'm hoping we get to see Susan too.
There's some interesting speculation that there's a loose end out there from the Day of the Doctor where we saw just Peter Capaldi's eyes. You remember when all the doctors had to get together and send Gallifrey off into a pocket dimension, and we saw just Peter Capaldi's eyes and him throwing the lever, and we never saw that. We've never seen that yet, and so some are speculating that that's going to get wrapped up this season.
And the actor you're talking about is David Bradley.
Thank you, David Bradley. Yes.
There's also a loose end from way back in the time of the first Doctor, with the very first companion departure. The Doctor's granddaughter, Susan, decided to stay on Earth in like the 22nd century in the wake of a Dalek invasion and get married. And the first Doctor had this elegant, I mean, really moving speech about, you know, I'm going to come back one day and go forward in all your beliefs and justify my confidence in you and stuff like that. And such a wonderful speech that they've periodically called back that speech in the history of Doctor Who and used that footage again. But he's never gone back and seen Susan again.
They've never paid it off.
So, they've never paid that off. And so I think it's awesome that we had in this episode we're going to talk about, we had a picture of Susan on his desk. I would love to have, if they bring back the first Doctor, I'd love to have them bring back Susan and pay that off too.
That would be interesting. So let's wrap up our little talk about Chibnall. He just did a couple other things, The Power of Three, which was Matt Smith, the Pawns, and Millions of Black Cubes All Over the Earth. Significant about that one was the reintroduction of UNIT, and it was the second to last episode with the Pawns. And then that led to another mini episode, which was called PS, which is really sort of a deleted scene that was never even taped. It was supposed to be in the Angels Take Manhattan, a final scene which would feature Rory's dad and their adopted son, you know, from that time, coming to deliver a letter from Amy and Rory to him to let him know what happened all these years later.
And you can read the script for it online, and it's actually very well written.
Yeah,
it's very moving.
I think it was very good. So that's Chris Chibnall. It'll be interesting to see, you know, what he comes up with. A lot of it will depend on, of course, who they choose as the next Doctor. So it's something to look forward to find out, well, once they name who the next Doctor is going to be. So
can I say one thing about my hopes for Chris Chibnall? The episodes that he's written have kind of, to my mind, been hits and misses. Some of them were really good, like 42. Others, at the other end, I hated Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, and the others were kind of in the middle, although I liked his mini episodes. I also love what he does on Broadchurch, even though it's very intense. I mean, it's a drama. It is about crimes that are disturbing and stuff, but it's very well done. And it has a very realistic sensibility to it. And one of the things that's characterized Stephen Moffat's time as showrunner on Doctor Who is it's been very unrealistic. Even compared to previous Doctor Who, this is not science fiction. This is science fairy tale.
Right.
And and while I appreciate a lot of things Stephen Moffat has done, I also see flaws in his tenure, and one of the flaws is I think he's gotten too unrealistic with the show. And I'm hoping that Chris Chibnall, when he's not writing under a Stephen Moffat set of rules, when he gets to do things his way, I'm hoping that he brings back a more realistic sensibility to the show. It still will be pretty close to science fantasy, but maybe not science fairy tale.
That's a good point. Moffat has a lot of skills, one of them being that ability to sort of map out a long story, that arc, and leaving clues all along that you never realized were clues until later. That's good. You're right. I mean, he often doesn't care when he leaves continuity errors or you know, the Deus Ex Machina endings and that sort of thing. So he's not really interested in making sure all that is as tight as it could be. The one thing I like about Broadchurch is as dark or as tough as the subject matter is, there's still lots of humor in it. He knows how to keep, you know, to balance out the tense and the drama with the humor. And I think that's key, because one of the things I love about Doctor Who, especially in the past, you know, the Moffat era, is the humor that runs through it, despite or in addition to or because of the tenseness, the tension and the drama that goes through it. I think humor is a key element to why I love Doctor Who so much, in addition to the drama. So, so with that, let's get into the recap. We're already almost 20 minutes into our recording. So let's get into our recap. So the title of the episode is The Pilot, which is, I think, an interesting name because, as we know, the pilot refers to a person in a situation in the story. But I wonder if it also is supposed to have maybe a double meaning, as in this is almost like a pilot episode, a fresh start for the Doctor. You know,
Very clearly.
Yeah. I mean, some people have complained the last few seasons have been dark. Maybe we're going to get something a little lighter. What do you think?
Well, I think they're definitely trying to reintroduce the show. The last few seasons have suffered in terms of ratings, and there's been a general decline in the ratings, and so they're trying to reattract viewers. And one way to do that is with what's called a soft reboot, where you kind of reinvent the series and reintroduce it to people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what they're doing here. They kind of stumbled with Peter Capaldi, with the fans. He came across in his first season as much harsher and more abrasive and crazy than what a lot of fans wanted. And then they softened him in his next season. And in this season, I think they've so far, I mean, we only have one episode to judge by, but I think they've continued in that vein. And he's the most rational and relatable that we've seen him. And so I think they are trying to do a soft reboot and use this as the pilot episode, the initial episode, to reintroduce people to the new, more relatable version of Peter Capaldi.
Hmm. I feel like maybe Nardal is part of that attempt. Nardal adds an element to the Doctor where he's not like one of these human companions who's in awe of or as manic as the Doctor. He's sort of, I think he sometimes plays the role, so in the two episodes we've seen him in so far, the role of, like Rory did, sort of grounding everyone a little bit, restraining or giving a perspective.
Yeah, although unlike Rory, he's a comedic character, I mean, at his core.
Right.
And I know some fans really don't like Nardal. Personally, I like Nardal. I think he's a nice presence on the show.
I agree. Rory was was the straight man.
Yeah.
So we open on the Doctor's office at the university. Any Easter eggs? Did you see anything particularly?
Oh, lots. Oh, yeah. Pictures, sock screwdrivers.
Yep. So we saw...
There's a raven from Face the Raven.
Right. There's most obvious ones, the photos on the Doctor's desk. They show us River and his granddaughter, Susan. Okay. What was that? I'm pretty sure that was a Rembrandt over the fireplace. Did you recognize it?
It's a picture of Beethoven, and then he plays the opening notes of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony on his guitar.
Okay. I knew it had a significance, but I wasn't sure. I found the music that they played very interesting. Like, kind of going back to the season being less dark and they're trying to make a softer, lighter Doctor, it was very lighthearted and peppy. It felt a little out of character of the typical Doctor Who music.
The kind of pacing of this episode was interesting. And I saw Stephen Moffat in an interview commenting on that instead of like starting with a bang, which is like how the revived 2005 series started, you know, in the first couple of minutes, we're in the middle of an Auton invasion and the Doctor is telling Rose Tyler, run for your life.
You know, they literally blew up the building.
And in this, we have this very calm, slow open that gradually builds. And Moffat was saying this was a deliberate choice to have this kind of slower, more gentle opening. And I think it really worked. I liked it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so then we have Bill and Nardal enter. So we, right off the bat, in a very little bit of clever bit of directing, you know, with no dialogue whatsoever, we have the explanation for how Nardal went from being a disembodied head to being evidently restored. We hear him clanking and squeaking and then throwing a bolt.
Yeah.
He comes in. So obviously he has some sort of robotic body.
Right.
Put a pin in that, and there we're done. So, and now we have Bill Potts. Mm-hmm. Why Bill, do you think? I mean, it seems sort of an odd choice for, I mean, maybe it's a British thing. Maybe you have girls named Bill in Britain, but it just seems an interesting choice of a name. Any thoughts yet? Or do you think this is going to be something that we're going to get later, or it's just random?
When I first heard it, I thought, well, that's interesting. She has a typically male name, and I thought that was an interesting choice. You know, we periodically encounter girls that have male names. In fact, there's one of the Eighth Doctor's companions in the audio series is a woman named Charlie. Her real name is like Charlene or something like that, but she's called Charlie. And they never make anything out of that. It's just a kind of neat personal quirk. And at first I thought, well, that's what it's going to be with Bill. It's just a kind of an interesting personal quirk that she goes by Bill. I thought it was kind of neat. As we learn more about her character, though, there may be a little more significance to the name than that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay, so we'll jump back into that. So what's interesting is the doctor has taken an interest in her. She's apparently attending his classes without being enrolled. She works in the school's cafeteria. And the thing that made her made him pay attention to her was he says she smiles instead of frowns when she doesn't understand something. That's an interesting idea that the doctor would be interested in someone who does that.
Yeah, that's totally a companion trait.
Yes. They're attracted to the unknown, and it makes them interested. And then he does something unexpected. He asks her to be – that he wants to – doesn't even ask her. He tells her that he's going to be her personal tutor. Every weekday evening he's going to educate her. It doesn't seem, based on the rest of the episode, that he was intending to make her a companion. Is he just lonely? What do you think?
I think he's torn. he's promised somebody that he's going to stay here on Earth and guard this Time Lord thing in a vault. And he's not supposed to go away from that. But, of course, he's the doctor. He wants to travel. He's been traveling for thousands of years now. And so I think he's using her as a kind of surrogate companion while he's stuck on Earth, not really planning to take her off of Earth.
Okay.
But still wanting that personal bond with somebody who's young and female and British, unlike Nardole.
Right.
And, you know, I wonder, too, if, you know, there's the doctor almost, he gets kind of a satisfaction out of the wonder that his companions have. You know, he doesn't have that wonder because he's seen it all. He's done it all. He's been everywhere. But then he's got his companions who haven't done that. And he gets kind of that wonder that he gets to vicariously experience through them.
Well, it's a parenting trait. I mean, as a father, that's one of the things that we enjoy is, you know, I've seen Star Wars a million times, but the first time I show Star Wars to my kids, I experience the wonder and joy of it through them. So I think it's a sort of a fatherly impulse in the doctor in that sense.
There's an interesting implication of a line of dialogue later in the episode, which suggests that Bill may not even be his first companion in this phase of life, because we later establish he's been teaching at this university for like 50 or 70 years. Mm-hmm. And when Bill first experiences the TARDIS and has her reaction, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, I think is awesome. The doctor at one point says to Nardole, "Does it seem to you this is taking longer than normal?" And that would imply Nardole has seen other companions have this reaction in the same time period that they've been traveling together since the death of River Song.
Exactly. Well,
there is a question, like, how long have they been together, Nardole and the Doctor? I mean, even more, maybe perhaps than the 50 years that they at this university, which is interesting that they chose 50 because that's about how long Doctor Who, the TV series, has been around. So it's kind of an interesting.
Well, and of course, it was an opportunity for them to throw in another that he looks old joke.
Yeah. Right.
Well, it's because how did he put it? Because I don't look that old, right? Oh, no, that's not it. You know, it moves on.
So, and just a note, it's apparently this is St. Luke's University in Bristol, England. I saw a reference that's where it is. One of the things I loved is that He, you know, lectured on, he had a lecture on quantum physics and then spoke about poetry the whole time. And he says, well, that's because they're the same thing. And they, because they rhyme. I love that approach. I love that idea that poetry and quantum physics are the same thing.
Well, they are.
Well, exactly. Then we get his lecture. I skipped over the elephant in the room, the sort of reveal about something about Bill. It turns out she's a lesbian, and this has been a big thing. I don't want to make it a big thing here necessarily, but all of the coverage of this, of her as a new companion, has made a big deal about her being the first gay companion and all the other stuff. They bring it out and they lay it on the table right off the bat. It becomes an element of this episode. Do you feel like this is going to be something we're going to see in every episode?
What I'm afraid of is it's going to end up. I'm blanking on the name of the series. DC Comics, the
Supergirl.
Well, Supergirl's one of them. Other's the Legends.
Legends of Tomorrow, DC's Legends of Tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, especially Legends of Tomorrow, where you basically have the time-traveling woman who corrupts other women of their time. It's basically what that character has become.
Right.
Sarah. You know, and I'm afraid that every episode they're going to try to work something in of, look at this time-traveling woman who's gay. You know, and it's like, okay, fine, make that a part of the character. You know, whatever, whether we like it or not, that's part of what they do. But just like we wouldn't want seeing a guy sleeping around every episode, I hope we don't see this every episode too, you know?
I don't think we're going to. I think that they, and part of the reason is because they're conscious of ratings. Right. And if they go too heavy-handed with this, it's going to alienate people. And I don't think that Bill is going to be another Captain Jack. Right. She's not the same person. She doesn't have the over-the-top flamboyant personality. Mm-hmm. She's a much more modest, sensible person. And so I would expect we'll get occasional references, and they may, by the end of the series, bring back that girl ship thing now.
Yeah,
because that would actually, if you think about the structure of the character story arc, a logical exit for Bill would be to go off with that character,
right?
Mm-hmm. And get shown the universe by this other character. But other than that, I don't expect this to be a big element of the series. I think they're going to play it soft.
Okay,
which I hope so. It's just something, it's anything when it deals with areas of sexuality, whether it's homosexuality, heterosexuality, whatever. It's better if it's not a major element, because frankly, we don't want to see it. We're not watching it for that.
Well, we're not watching it for that. This is fundamentally a children's show. And it's a commentary on our times that this kind of material is even being presented in a children's show.
Right.
But exactly. That's the times we're living in, unfortunately.
Yep. Yeah.
So, it's interesting. I wonder if Bill, given that idea that at the end she'll go fly off with Heather Skyship, Bill is probably a one and done companion. In that, with everything switching over to a new showrunner and a new doctor, I wonder if that also means that Bill is a one season companion.
Thus far, she's only been contracted for the one season, but the BBC has said normally we don't comment, because there was rumors that she would be just a one season companion, and the BBC came out and was deliberately ambiguous about it and said, sure, we normally don't comment on when a companion leaves. There are lots of precedents actually for holding over a companion to a new doctor to provide an element of stability in the show, but there's also precedent for having a clean slate. And so it kind of remains to be seen which approach they're going to take this time. But my guess is that Bill probably will only be with us for a season.
Yeah. Well, given that the last time we changed showrunners, we changed companion and doctor. That was when Moffat came in. So the next part, I don't want to skim over this because it was so good, was this lecture the doctor gave, this montage. And I just kind of want to read what he says, because I felt like it was really significant. I mean, they took a lot of time with this, and I wonder if this is going to be significant as we go along the season. So he says, "Time doesn't pass. The passage of time is an illusion because life only lets you see one day at a time. You remember being alive yesterday. You hope you're going to be alive tomorrow, so it feels like you're traveling one to the other. But nobody's moving anywhere. Movies don't move. They're just pictures. Lots and lots of pictures. All of them still. None of them moving. Just frozen moments. But if you experience those pictures one after the other, then everything comes alive." Then we get a little break where Bill talks to her foster mom, and then we're back to the lecture. "Imagine if time all happened at once. Every moment of your life laid out around you like a city. Streets full of buildings made of days. The day you were born, the day you die, the day you fall in love, the day love ends. A whole city built from triumph and heartbreak and boredom and laughter and cutting your toenails. It's the best place you'll ever be. Time is a structure relative to ourselves. Time is a space made by our lives where we stand together forever. Time and relative dimension and space, it means life." So, is this just gobbledygook from Stephen Moffat, or is this meaningful? Go ahead. I'll let you guys talk before I break my theory.
Father Corey, if you have comments, why don't you go first, because I have some comments.
Yeah, well, you know, it strikes me this is a very common philosophic way, if you want to put it, of looking at time, you know, the time strip idea of we're just walking through one snapshot after another, after another, after another, after another, and all we see is the one snapshot of where we're sitting right now. Yeah, I mean, that part of it is fairly common, and of course, that's the appearance of time that allows for time travel, because then all you have to do is rewind the tape to see an earlier snapshot, or fast forward the tape to see a later snapshot. You know, and of course, I think that's part of what they were going at. And of course, there's this idea that the doctor can see all of time and space and everything. And, you know, they've made big issues out of that earlier in the series where, you know, he sees everything, he knows everything, you know, almost kind of thing. Not literally, but he's so much more aware of time and space than we are. And it's almost like he's trying to describe that's what he sees. That's what he experienced. And of course, Bill brings that up later.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes, she mentions that later.
Right. Okay.
So go ahead, Jimmy.
I thought there were nice aspects to the speech. I thought it was nice that the series is exploring something that's actually a philosophical implication of its central premise, which is that time travel is possible. Because the only way time travel is possible is if the past, the present, and the future are all real. And that's actually a view that's very common in Catholic theology. Not everybody agrees on this, and people have different opinions, but it's actually a very common opinion among theologians that the past, present, and future are all real, and God then views them from this eternal now outside of time. And so it's neat to see that being explored in the series. I've explored it a lot myself. I've thought about it a lot. In fact, recently I did a series of blog posts on this. And if you want to see those, you can Google Jimmy Akin, "Are the Past and the Future Real?" And that'll get you to them. I kind of was irked by the bit about time, the passage of time is an illusion. That's not true. I agree the past and the future are real, but we do, in a sense, pass from one to another, obviously, because we're not experiencing the past and the future. I would say it's not an illusion. It's just a change of perspective from one part of space-time to another. So that was just kind of a personal annoyance. My main annoyance, though, was I thought the speech went on for too long. Mm. And I thought it had poetic elements, but I don't know. It may be because I'm so familiar with this set of concepts, I wasn't as impressed by it. But I just thought it kind of slowed down a little. I would have kept the speech, but I would have cut it some and made it a little shorter.
Well, that's one of the reasons I thought it might be significant, because you have 42 minutes, or actually I think the episodes are a little longer, but you have a limited amount of time, and you've taken it up with a significant chunk with this montage. And I feel like maybe this is some kind of clue for this season, what we're going, you know, the overarching story that's going to be told here, or something along those lines. But I felt like this was a, this, we're going to explore this concept somewhat as we go along.
Yeah, and it may well have significance for the overall story. I mean, we may, if they bring back the First Doctor, that's kind of the Doctor's own city of history is surrounding him. So it may play that function. It also plays two functions on the narrative level within this episode. One is it shows us what the Doctor has been doing in his lectures, because that's a big question, you know, for us. We don't want to just hear he's been giving lectures. We want to see one. And it shows Bill's relationship with him as a student in the lectures, because we've been told she's been attending. We want to see that, too. But then it also sets up the concept of the TARDIS, because he even uses the phrase time and relative dimension in space in the lecture. And then once Bill is actually on the TARDIS, he pays that off by calling back that line and then saying TARDIS for short.
And also they show Heather in the lecture as he speaks about the day you were born, the day you die, the day you fall in love, the day love ends. So I, you know, a bit of foreshadowing right there in that in that moment as well. So speaking of Heather, we have this character who has a star-shaped defect in her iris. And it's a very odd detail, which is never explained, but it's just sort of dropped there.
Yeah. Also, that was the original title for this episode. In production, before it was called The Pilot, it was called The Girl with the Star in Her Eye.
Which is a interesting, acute title. Yeah,
kind of a double entendre.
Yes. Yeah. It's it was an odd choice, but a necessary one for the way that the alien creature or device gets discovered, because you know it's such a prominent asymmetrical. physical characteristic is important here.
Incidentally, when they did that, where you look in the pool and Bill says something is wrong, I totally called it that it was that it was not that it was going to be the symmetry issue.
Yeah,
I know I previously was aware that one of the reasons we hate photographs of ourselves is because we're not used to seeing ourselves the way others see us. When we see ourselves, we see ourselves in a mirror, which reverses our image. And so when we see a photograph that doesn't reverse our image, we look strange to ourselves.
Because as the Doctor says, our faces, we think they're symmetrical, but they're not. There are differences. So before we get to the puddle, there is a moment where the Doctor and Nardole are in the basement with this vault that has Gallifreyan writing on it. And Bill overhears them talking. And I find it, we never get the explanation of what it is. Again, this is a mystery we're opening up, but that's not paid off yet. Which is fine. Those come up. Nardole says to the Doctor, of Bill at this point, that he's not supposed to get involved. You know, like, why are you tutoring her? You're not supposed to get involved. Why do you think that is? Why is this the Doctor's self-imposed rule, something else having to do with the vault? What do you think?
Hard to say.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's we're going to find out more about. What is in this vault? Why is it so important the Doctor watch it? Well, is it Time Lords that asked him to watch it? Is there somebody else who asked him to watch it? You know, so it's going to be, obviously we found the big overarching element of this series is the vault and what's in it.
Yeah.
Being guarded by the most irresponsible person in the universe.
Exactly. By the way, did you happen to notice, Jimmy, the Mary Celeste nameplate?
No, I didn't.
So what was that? So it's kind of almost in that hallway there by the stairs. You got the stairs where the water runs down. There is a Mary Celeste nameplate laying there or propped up against the wall. And, of course, Mary Celeste was the ship that the Doctor landed on in his first incarnation, the first Doctor, in the chase.
Right, yeah.
He landed on the ship, and the Daleks showed up, and they thought the Daleks were, you know, some monster, the abandoned ship. And that's why the Mary Celeste was abandoned.
In that case, look out for any references to the Empire State Building in the rest of the series, because also in the chase, the Daleks show up on the top of the Empire State Building, another famous scene from that series.
That's right.
That was
an episode where half the episode was just them jumping around through time and space to avoid the Daleks, and the Daleks are hot on their tail, and
they go through a haunted house and all kinds of fun stuff in that series.
Yeah, it was actually a lot of fun. That was a fun episode.
Oh, good. And this was early Doctor Who, the first Doctor.
First Doctor.
This was first season, as I recall. Yeah. I think the chase was one of the first.
I don't think it was first season, but it was first Doctor. It was right before the introduction of his companion, Stephen. And right. I think it may have been the exit for his companion, Barbara.
Yes,
and,
you're right. Yeah. Yep, you're right. It was.
Okay.
I forgot about the end of the episode. They left. It was 2 years. So it must have been third.
Second season or something.
Third season. Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Following this little bit about the vault, Bill encounters Heather. Heather is very sad. She wants to leave. And then sort of on an impulse, this is a sort of an odd moment. I'm not sure why Heather is obsessed with this puddle that she needs to drag Bill to see it. There's a very odd, I don't know if it's just a hole. I don't think it was written well or something.
There doesn't seem to be any explanation there of why she was so, and you know, it almost seemed like at first she was already infected, if you will, by whatever it was that was taking her over.
Some compulsion.
You know, I mean, she just acted very, very odd, and I don't know if that just the acting wasn't very good there, or if they wanted to have that almost kind of that haunted look to her. But
right,
yeah, it just there was no explanation why she ended up in this corner parking lot with the big puddle and
the puddle that never
she's
evaporates.
Obsessed with it. And yeah, I did like the line about, well, half the students here are blokes.
Yeah.
Didn't expect them to go there.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say it's New England. We have puddles that last all year round from potholes. So she takes her to the puddle, and on the way she talks about how much she wants to leave Bristol, which is a significant, you know, the moment here. She wants to leave. She wants to go. And that becomes a motivation. Bill keeps saying, you know, she wants to go with her. You know, you know, she's attracted to her, apparently. And there's something wrong with the puddle. It's not a reflection. Of course, the girl with the star in her eye, one eye, would notice this because the star would be on the wrong side. And then we have the creepy voice inside the puddle say, "Pilot is located," which is always not a good thing. And then that's almost
in an airport, actually. You know.
Yeah.
Well, try that with a creepy voice. "Pilot is located."
Yeah.
I'm not getting on that plane.
Maybe we should walk up to our good friend Captain Jeff Nielsen like that.
"Pilot is located." next time I see Jeff, I'm going to say that. So we move to Christmas, another awkward Christmas with the Doctor, wearing paper crowns, and they have this moment where Bill says, she says her mom always said, some people you can smell the wind in their clothes, but she never knew her mom. So there's this sort of like, how do you know this? And she says, I hear my mom's voice, right? She was a baby when her mom died. But she hears her mom inside her, which is an odd little bit. And then she's supposed to look like her. It makes me wonder about the origins of Bill. And maybe there's going to be something more science fiction-y about her origins than normal.
That would be totally in line for Doctor Who, because they like doing that all the time, where these seemingly normal people end up being something very, very different.
Right.
I mean, how many versions of Rory did we end up with? Like we talked about him earlier. I mean,
right, and Clara, you know, Clara's origins were shrouded in mystery. Never mind her ultimate disposition. She says that she's supposed to look like her mom, but doesn't have any pictures of her. And then we go to the next scene with the foster mom. And I missed this on my first watch, and it was really odd. But now I think I have an idea of why. Her foster mom says, "Oh, by the way, I found a box in the back of the cupboard of your mom, pictures of your mom. I don't know why I never noticed that."
Yeah, didn't know we had them.
Yeah, and then as Bill looks through the pictures, she finds one of her mom, and there's a reflection of the photographer in a mirror behind her mom, and it's the doctor taking her picture.
Yeah, right.
And so now I think what my theory is, I had a bizarre theory, I'm not even going to bother going into it, but I think my theory is, it's very simple. The doctor hadn't gotten her a Christmas gift, so he traveled back in time, took pictures of her mom, or got to know her mom, and then hid them in where her foster mom would find them as a Christmas gift.
Yes.
I think it's probably that simple and nothing.
That's exactly it. And that's also why the rug that Bill gives the doctor is now under the TARDIS, because he took the TARDIS on a trip and materialized it over the rug.
Right.
Yep.
Right. Okay.
Also, by the way, I hate the character of the foster mom. I think we have this unsympathetic, unlikable foster mom.
Yeah,
it's cheap writing. She's just a nasty character, and I think it's lazy writing.
I think we should
see a sympathetic portrayal of a foster mom instead of she's like Jackie, only even less likable.
It perpetuates this idea that all foster parents are bad people.
Exactly.
And I think it's unfortunate. I think if you're trying to break stereotypes, then that would be a good one to break. Plus, if Bill is old enough to be attending university and have a full-time job, she's really an adult. Mm-hmm. So if she's still living with this woman who was her foster mom, it would imply that there's a relationship. There's a some type of
warm relationship.
Yeah, there's a relationship there. So it's a bit odd that one. Yeah, you're right. So now we jump forward in time. It's springtime. You know, no one's walking around in heavy coats. And Bill finds Heather standing at the puddle again, because apparently Heather likes to come and stare at the puddle. And then she says, I'll come around and meet you, Bill says. Don't go anywhere. Don't go anywhere without me. Famous last words. And then by the time she gets around, Heather has disappeared. And then we hear the creepy voice again. Pilot confirmed. Pilot engaged. Or passenger. Was it pilot engaged or passenger engaged? Something like, I think it was something like, the implication is we have the pilot, now we're going for the passenger.
And in a reverse angle shot, we learn Heather's been eaten by
yes.
the puddle.
Poor Heather.
Yep.
So Bill goes off and tells the doctor, and in the midst of her conversation, she notices he's running away outside. And
he's already outside and running as she's still talking.
Yeah, running like a penguin with his arse on fire, as she says. And then he's a great line of dialogue. That's my face, yeah? Seems a bit flexible on the subject. Well, you have no idea. the doctor's face could be implied. The doctor's face can be different at times, and then she asks him if he knows any sci-fi, and gives her a bit of a look, and she proffers this theory that that Heather has been possessed by a lizard in her brain, and she got it from Netflix. It's kind of interesting that this and a couple other references kind of show that Bill is going to be sort of this pop culture knowledge, that she's going to be sort of predisposed to this, like to basically be like one of the fans.
Mm-hmm.
So as a fan analog,
do either of you know? I mean, I wondered if that reference is. It doesn't seem to quite fit the series V.
Yes, that was my first thought. But V was they were lizard like beings that took on
pretending
human.
To be human. Yeah,
flesh versus. Yeah, I was trying to think if there would be something like Invasion of the Body Snatchers or something like that, you know.
With lizards,
yeah.
Well,
I can't think of a movie like that, though, but...
The only thing I thought of was Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, with the SETI eels.
Oh. Yes.
Yeah, the little brain leeches.
Brain leeches.
Yeah.
Poor Chekhov. But back to Doctor Who. they say if you have a Chekhov in the second act, you... He gets fired at the end, or something. So He notices it's not a mirror image, it's a mimicry. He notices the symmetrical scorch marks and immediately sends Bill home. Actually, this is where we get the passenger selected, pursuit engaged. Yep. So now another thing that kind of drove me a little crazy here. Bill gets home. She hears the shower running, assumes it's her foster mom, then gets a call from her foster mom, and then she knows, well, no one is supposed to be there. What? Okay, I'm going to ask both of you. In those instances, what's the first thing you do? If that were you?
Yeah. Get a weapon, something.
Get a gun, call the cops, run away. Not run into the room, holding an umbrella. So
and make sure they're decent before they go in.
Yes, I'm warning you, put some clothes on.
Admittedly, the get your gun option may not be as commonly available in England.
Well, this is true.
What I would do
In that case, get your sword, because I'm sure all British households have swords. That's a thing, right?
Oh, must be. Yeah.
Suits of armor too, I think.
So she goes in, and she discovers, that wet footprints, and nobody's in there, and then sees a starry eye in the shower drain. And again, I'm kind of left with this: what's the creature doing? Like, was it there to take her? But so why didn't it? You know what I mean? It sort of ran away instead of
is a shower burst.
it's sort of an odd I know why they're doing this. They're introducing this suspense of this creature in pursuit, yep. But from within the logic of the story, it doesn't really make sense. But that's just me.
Well, you always got to have the suspense. You got to build up to it because we don't know what it is, and it's kind of like having the creature coming out of the shadows or something like that. It's kind of just building the suspense is really what it serves to do.
Right.
What would have made more sense is if Bill heard gurgling in the bathroom, mm-hmm. and came in, and the liquid creature was coming up out of the drain.
Yes,
that would have made more sense.
Right. Yes, I agree. That would have fit. So it was an odd choice of the way they chose to do that. So Bill runs for the doctor, and before she can get into the university building, she sees Heather standing there. Dripping water, reminding me of the people from Water of Mars.
Oh yes,
the special effects guys got to drag that hose out again and pour water all over the poor actress for hours on end. I'm sure. I hope it was warm water. But she, given that she had just seen the starry eye again, this is another one of those things. Why didn't Bill run? Like, this is a very odd thing. This is a wrong thing happening here. Run to the doctor. Quick, keep going. So it's just an odd dramatic choice. She does this several times. The moments when you think run away, she doesn't. And maybe this goes back to as I think about it, maybe this goes back to what the doctor said earlier. When you see something you don't understand, you don't frown, you smile. She's drawn toward the things that she doesn't understand, as opposed to run away from. So maybe that's what it is.
Well, I mean, just pure speculation. Maybe there's something about this intergalactic, super intelligent oil that draws people to it.
Yeah, the vampire's gaze.
That's wild speculation, but
I think you're being too kind. It's just bad writing.
Well, that's true too. No, I'm not going to disagree with that. Like I said, that's speculation.
in fact, as nice as the line is about smiling when you don't understand something, she's not smiling at this point.
That's true.
And I'm guessing she's not going to be smiling through the rest of the season when she doesn't understand something. That was kind of more a line than anything else.
Yep. Right, right. So we get to the doctor's office, pursued by Wet Heather. And the doctor, says, "Let's, we pop into the box." And so we get that moment that we always get with that every companion, every new companion, the first impressions of the box. And it's it's amusing, it's funny. They always played up for some good laughs. She calls it a really posh kitchen. Keeps completely misunderstanding the nature of the TARDIS. You know, so the Doctor says something, you know, dramatic and bold, and the music swells. And she says, "Can you point me to the loo?"
Yeah.
So kind of deflates.
It's a lift.
Yeah, it's a lift. Yeah.
It's always interesting, you know, to see what someone's reaction is going to be. And, you know, the classic is just amazement and pointing out it's bigger on the inside. But they've had some neat variations on that over the years. Back during Tom Baker's reign, there as the Fourth Doctor, there was a moment where an established character who had never been on the TARDIS before, his name was Sergeant Benton. He'd been in many episodes. And when he first enters the TARDIS, he just stands there. And Tom Baker turns to him and says, like, "Aren't you going to comment on the fact it's bigger on the inside?" And he says, "Well, I thought that was kind of obvious." And then another neat one is in the Christmas special where Clara is introduced,
yep.
The 18th century version, and she runs in, sees it, runs out, runs around it, comes back in and says, "It's smaller on the outside."
That's right.
And that was a neat variation. But I really liked Bill's, where she got it in stages,
yes.
And she keeps having naturalistic explanations. Like when she first sees it, it's up against a wall, and she naturally assumes that the reason it seems bigger when she goes through the door is it's a knock-through, that there's a hole in the wall behind it, and it's built into the structure of the building. And then when it starts, the machinery starts to move, she concludes it's an elevator, a lift,
yeah.
and you get this delayed realization, and I love the way she keeps misunderstanding it. I think it's a great variation.
Well, you know, that's one thing I do like about her as a character, at least so far. She doesn't seem like the overly clever companion. Clara kind of got to that point where she was almost trying to be as clever as the Doctor was. And Bill, there's no pretense of that. She's trying to figure it out, and she keeps going back to cheesy sci-fi movies.
And Amy actually had that too. She became very Doctor-like by the end. In fact, in Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, she's like using the sonic screwdriver the way the Doctor would.
Right,
and I kind of like that. That Bill is just like an average person who's trying to figure out what's going on, and the way she knows, you know, well, nothing too clever, nothing too special. It's just like, okay, this is what I know, and this kind of fits there, so this works.
I think she's
very refreshing as a character. She's very likable.
She reminds me a lot of Donna Noble in the way she relates with the Doctor. One of the aspects of her, if she's lesbian, that means that there's no romantic tension with the Doctor, which I think is, I think we need time to kind of set that aside for a while, for a few companions. I feel like that natural or realistic reaction is a lot like Donna's. I mean, Donna was always deflating him. So between Nardole and Bill, there seems to be the two of them sort of emulate that aspect of Donna's relationship with the Doctor, which was which fun.
They kind of split it between them because Donna was, you know, was kind of knowing and cynical and jaded in a way. And even though he's not jaded, Nardole is knowing. He's like from the 50-something century, so he's familiar with the Doctor's world of technology and sci-fi. He's from that world. Whereas Bill, even though she has this kind of commonsensical Donna-like approach, she also has this hopeful, youthful, let's explore vibe that's a little bit more kind of fresher in a way than the more jaded, mature Donna.
That's good. Yeah, I agree. So we move several stages. We move outdoors, then we move all the way to Australia. And we have another one of these moments where Bill kind of is kind of figuring things out. I love how she points out the inconsistencies of the TARDIS. She points out that it's an English acronym. So if it's alien, how could it be English? And that
actually, there are ways around that linguistically. It could work.
They
pointed out.
Yeah, and that it's disguised as a police box that says "pull to enter" on the front. It's not a very good
to hide
exactly. Which is also great because you don't actually pull the door to enter; you push
it. Yep.
The doors open inward. And then the creature falls from Australia, and then they travel 23 million years into the future and find out that the creature can travel through time and space, apparently.
Cool, and then alien planet, by the way.
Yeah.
I liked it. That was nice.
A sky made of lemon drops.
This guy was made of lemon drops, yeah. I love Nardole. You can be silly, ridiculous, or you can be silly sometimes.
And the Doctor had a great expression. I mean, again, I think it's part of that, the Doctor's softer, sillier side a little bit, is that he's going to be a little more of this sort of thing. He's asked, I think it's Nardole asks, is it dangerous? And he says, most things are dangerous. And then Bill says, so it's evil. And then he says, hardly anything is evil, but most things are hungry. Hunger looks very like evil from the wrong end of the cutlery. Or do you think your bacon sandwich loves you back?
I love that line.
it was a good line. And I think when he says, like, hardly anything is evil, I think he means, like, most of the natural world. You know,
yeah.
A tiger is not evil when it attacks you. It's just doing what it does. It eats. You know, it looks like a bacon sandwich, or you look like a bacon sandwich.
Yeah. Now, the Daleks, the Cybermen, he would definitely say are evil.
Right. And it goes to that, one of the fundamental aspects that makes the Doctor Who different from other shows, which is the Doctor isn't about conquering others or, you know, he has enemies, but even in the midst of having those enemies, he still treats them like beings that have an internal, that you respect, that they're following their own internal logic in many ways. I mean, the Daleks is a bit more of a, they're evil, but even there, he has at times treated them with a mercy that maybe they shouldn't deserve.
And there have been Daleks that aren't all bad.
Right. So the Doctor, this is when the Doctor does his explainer, kind of lays it out that the puddle is a super intelligent oil leak or shape-shifting fluid that can become anything, which would be really handy. And it seems to be responding to Heather's desire to leave, but it's also after Bill, and she like stares into the puddle again, like, it's going to grab you. Lean back from the puddle, Bill. This is why I keep thinking maybe Father Corey's right. Maybe this was intentional, like it's supposed to have a vampire gaze that hypnotizes. But or maybe it's just bad writing, like Jimmy said.
It's just, yeah.
So the Doctor decides to, you know, the only thing that can take care of it is the deadliest fire in the universe, which is the Daleks, and takes them into the midst of a time war zone?
No, it's a callback to the fourth and fifth Doctor era. They're fighting this group of people in kind of spandex jumpsuits with white dreadlocks, and that's actually a race of androids known as the Mavellans. And back during the fourth and fifth Doctor era, the Mavellans were like enemies of the Daleks, and they were kind of both bad guys, but they fought each other. And so that's the Doctor's taken her into the Dalek Mavellan war.
Oh, cool. Oh, good. I'm glad you cleared that up for me, because, I love getting these little bits. This is why we listen to Secrets of Doctor Who, people. This is why I do it, because I want to get all the background and the little bits. So he sends Nardole off to run interference while they look for a Dalek. Poor Nardole. running around with a screwdriver, blowing things up, attracting attention. But the Dalek has no effect on Heather. Some people I saw online complain that the Daleks were misused here, that they were, you know, the Daleks are the, you know, implacable enemy, the very dangerous. And here they just, they're sort of thrown away.
There's a reason for that. The sequence with Bill and the Daleks was originally shot to introduce, way before the series, to introduce her as the Doctor's new companion. They wanted a short action sequence that was dramatic and that would provide an intro for this character. So they shot like a 2-minute video or something of her and the Doctor running from Daleks. And then Stephen Moffat, when he wrote this episode, said, well, how are we going to tie that in? He didn't want to just abandon it and leave fans wondering, well, where does that happen in the Doctor's timeline? And originally he had the whole sequence in here, and they found it didn't work, so he just used a bit of it and added some new material to make it more fit the context in the episode, but it's still kind of shoehorned in there. Mm-hmm. And so the real reason the Daleks appear here in this episode is not because the logic demands it, but because they had been used in a promotional video to introduce Bill to the fans.
Okay. Don't want to waste any footage.
Can't do that. The deadliest fire in the universe, and it goes right through her.
Right. It has no effect on Wet Heather. That's my name for her, by the way. That's I don't know if anybody noticed, but that's what I'm going to call her from now on. It's Wet Heather.
Okay.
And now we realize that in typical Doctor Who fashion, that the creature is not trying to hurt them or kill them. It's just responding to Heather's desire or recollection that, as it had absorbed her, to take Bill with her as they went away.
Yep.
Bill and Heather have this moment, or Wet Heather, and have this moment where they share the memories of the universe, of her travels through the universe, maybe? Is that perhaps what that was?
I think that's what's going on. I also think it wasn't set up right because you have this, I mean, she's just been running from this thing and terrified of it. Why is she going to reach out and bond with it now?
Right.
And it would have been better to have it just temporarily grab her and share these memories with her and then have the doctor pull her away.
I found it kind of interesting because we've established that the doctor is not taking companions now. And this, creature spaceship part is basically offering to make Bill her companion as traveling through time and space. So almost tried to subvert the doctor in a sense, swoop in and steal away his potential companion. I thought that was an interesting, and maybe that had an effect on what the doctor ends up doing next. Wet Heather leaves when Bill rejects the offer. We go back to the university office, and she tells the doctor that she was too scared to go away with her, and the doctor says scared is good. And then he tells her
she's not human anymore.
Right. That Wet Heather is not human anymore, and that we probably won't see her again. He tells her that you probably won't see her again. And then he tells Bill that now you have to forget about the TARDIS, and he goes to wipe her memories. And this is part of that idea, maybe, that that now is not a time when he wants to have a companion? Maybe?
Well, I think it's that he doesn't want... he doesn't want her to be his companion. I mean, on some level he does, but this is fitting the narrative of I need to stay and guard this vault, and it's going to be a burden for you to have these memories of the universe, so I'm going to take them away as an act of mercy.
Right.
And he starts to do to her what he's previously done to Donna.
Yep.
And also what was done to him.
Exactly.
By Clara. Bill has this great speech where she talks him out without even realizing it. She talks him out of doing the mind wipe on her. And it's really nice.
She says, imagine how it would feel to have someone do this to you.
You.
And then we hear the Clara theme music come back. So the clear implication is he has some memory of some sort of having his memory wiped, or that at least that there's a hole in his memory related perhaps to someone whose face he can't remember but might be Clara. I think...
Right, that was made explicit at the end of Clara's departure.
Right.
Because she's in the diner talking to him. He's talking about this companion, to her, about this companion he can't remember. He knows his mind has been wiped, and it's bugging him that he can't remember this person he cares so much about. And so he feels very intensely what it would happen to have a hole in his memory like that.
Okay. Yep. I should have watched that episode. It's been, again, over a year and a half almost since I've seen it.
Yeah.
So so he tells her to run, and then she leaves after he doesn't wipe her memory, and then kind of speaks to the pictures of River and Susan. He tells them, shut up. And then then the TARDIS makes a noise.
And the TARDIS.
and he says he promised not to do that anymore, which apparently is he promised not to take a companion. And as you brought up before, Jimmy, promised whom? That's a,
right.
A
I think
good
it's
question.
The Time Lords.
It could be after. I mean, given what happened with Clara, and the drastic actions he took against the Time Lords to save Clara, I'm going to guess there had to have been repercussions, and maybe that's what this vault has to do with, is something to do with the repercussions from his actions with Clara's departure.
That's an interesting theory. It could actually echo another element of Doctor Who history, because originally, so the Doctor left Gallifrey, went around the universe interfering. The Time Lords, at the end of the second Doctor's time, put a stop to that. And they forced him to regenerate, and they grounded him on Earth. And they took away his knowledge of how to work the TARDIS. And so that gave us the John Pertwee era, which started with the Doctor being grounded on Earth for a couple of seasons. And because he had broken Time Lord law. And so this could, in a way, be repercussions from what the Doctor did to the government on Gallifrey to rescue Clara. He broke Time Lord law in a big way again. This could be their way of grounding him, saying, okay, you need to stay on Earth and guard this Time Lord artifact for now.
Mm. We'll see. It'd be interesting to see how that pans out.
Yep.
So, but then as she goes outside, he meets her outside with a TARDIS and says time changed his mind. And it's an interesting question. Does it mean he took time that he's now traveled through time and thought about it and come back, or that the TARDIS, which is time and relative dimensional space, changes mind or something? I don't know. It's supposed to be ambiguous, I think.
It is, but I think the decisive thing, I mean, he's already being tempted. He knows his previous companions, River and Susan, would want him to take her to see the universe, and the TARDIS comments. You know, we know the TARDIS is a sentient being, and the TARDIS comments on that, and it's like, this is what you need to do, and that's what convinces him.
Right. Okay. So, and then,
like that. It was like the TARDIS clearing its throat. Let's get going.
Yes, exactly.
The Doctor's wife, as we had done that one episode.
Exactly.
And then, so the end of the episode, coming up this season, we get a little teaser of some images from throughout the season.
An apparent regeneration.
Yes, which we know that his time is coming to an end. Of course, that could be a misdirection. Maybe some regeneration energy experience happens. We've seen that happen. What stood out to me was we'll see Missy again. But we're also going to see the Harold Saxon version of the Master.
Yes,
that actor back again. Whether that's actually the Master or not, that still remains to be seen. But
there has been speculation that they're going to do a Two Masters episode, just like they've done Two Doctors episodes.
Right,
and that having multiple Masters together is something that Big Finish has done before, but this will be the first time on TV, and. There has been a couple of notes about this one. Number one, I predict we get to see the regeneration of the Sims Master into Missy. Okay. I'm betting we're going to see that. We've seen other regenerations of the Master, kinda, and I'm betting we're going to see that. Also, I want to say his first name is John Sims. I may be mistaken, but I think you're right.
I think you're right on that one.
He's wearing a goatee, which makes him look like the classic original version of the Master, played by Roger Delgado, and later by Anthony Ainley. Yeah. And so he's harking back to earlier versions of the Master, which I actually think is good. John Sims was not my favorite Master. He was too dissimilar from the classic Masters, but I like that he's cutting in that direction now, and I think that just like they may be bringing back the first Doctor, we may actually get more Masters than just John Sims and Missy, and that would be
really cool. Now that would be interesting, especially the the particularly unlovely to look at versions of the early master.
It's like a walking corpse.
Yeah. No wonder why he's evil. So that's it. That's it from us. Do you have any last thoughts on this episode? I mean, we kind of dissected it pretty good.
I thought it was a great start to the series. I'm more optimistic about this series than I was about the last two after the first episode. Mm-hmm. So I hope they keep with the direction they've established for this season, and I look forward to seeing what they've got in store.
So it looks like how about you, Father Corey? Before I jump.
No, I agree. I think it's if they had set it up as a reboot pilot, to use the term purposely, I think they did a good job of that. Of just let's get everything back out there, quickly and simply, make it clear what's going on here. So if people do pick up this season, they'll know what's happening right from the beginning. They don't have to go back and look at the old episodes.
Okay. So just to kind of look forward to the season, that's sort of the logistics of it. It's a 12 episode season. It ends, the regular part of the season ends the 1st of July. There is a 3-part arc in the 6th, 7th, and 8th episodes, and the finale is going to be a 2-part story. That one is written by Moffat. The first part of the 3-parter is also written by Moffat. Those are the only ones written by him. And then, we'll have the Christmas special. The Doctor leaves after the Christmas special, so...
Right. He regenerates or at least the regeneration will be complete in the Christmas special.
Right.
And there we'll get a little bit of new material of the next Doctor written by Chris Chibnall.
Right. And presumably between July and Christmas, we'll find out who the next Doctor will be, who will play the next Doctor.
If not sooner.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything else significant in all of that. They say, yeah, no, there's nothing really. I was just looking at the Wikipedia page for the season 10. There's some interesting episode titles. The last episode of the season is titled The Doctor Falls, which, could be anything, so I wouldn't read too much into it. Okay, so next week we'll be back. First I want to say to the listeners, what did you think of this episode? What did you think of what we thought about this episode? Tell us what you think of the new companion, what we're going to see the next season. Let us know. Go visit tridio.com, TRIDEO.com. Find our show page, comment on the episode, or go to Secrets of Doctor Who Facebook page. Just look for Secrets of Doctor Who on Facebook. Leave us some feedback. Let us know what you thought. We'll be back next week. We'll discuss the next episode, which is titled Smile, which apparently is an emoji reference. Until then, Jimmy, where can people find you online?
They can find me at jimmyakin.com. That's kind of the hub of all my online activities. So they can check me there. Also, I'm on Facebook and Twitter and all over the place.
Okay. And Father Corey?
You can go to my website, frcorey.org. That's probably the easiest place as well. I haven't been spending a lot of time on the Twitters and the Facebooks, but you can still find me there. At least you can find my account there, frcoreystika, last name spelled STICHA.
And then you can all find me at my website, betnet.com, BETTNET.com, and links from there to all the other things I'm doing, including a new podcast I want to plug right now, because it's mine, the host, and I can do that, I'm doing a new podcast with my friend Father Chip Hines. We call it The Father's Show, and you can find that at thefathersshow.com, and it's just we're two different kinds of fathers talking about stuff that interests us, sports, beer, movies, TV shows, and whatnot. Go check it out. We've got about 9 episodes done, and let me know what you think if you give it a listen. So with that, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on The Secrets of Doctor Who.
When will I see you again?
Soon, I expect. Or later. One of the two.
things.